This past week, WILL AM 580 Agricultural Director Charles Lindy died at age 49 from cancer. For the next half hour, we'll be looking back at his career, and we'll be hearing the thoughts of some of those who he worked with, as well as some of Charles' own thoughts about his illness and his life. Charles created WILL's agricultural programming, from our daily updates to the closing market report to Commodity Week to Outlook meetings. Serving the farmer audience was always at the forefront of his mind.
The way we're going to proceed today is like we always do. We're going to give our panelists an opportunity for an opening comment, and then I'll ask the first question. At that point, the whole idea of doing these Outlook meetings is to come out here and give you the opportunity to ask your questions. So let's go ahead and start the first session today. We're very pleased.
Charles would ask tough questions and demand answers. In an industry where agricultural reporters and sources often have close relationships, Charles kept his distance. His desire to gather the facts of a story and report them accurately and objectively, and his belief in avoiding any appearance of a conflict of interest were traits greatly admired. Before he died, Charles recorded a series of interviews with reporter Dave Dickey, during which he reflected on his illness and his work.
Could you share with us the first remembrances that you had that you were sick?
Well, I was driving along, and I had lost 150 pounds in a year between, say, July of 99 and July of 2000. And I started having a pain down around my tailbone. And I just didn't think anything of it as I was driving. Then I went to the doctor about it, and they thought it was just some kind of infection. So they gave me some antibiotics. I went back a second time. They gave me antibiotics. I went back a third time, and they gave me antibiotics. And said, if it doesn't work this time, you might have a pilonidal cyst. And so it didn't work. So we went to the surgeon here in town who was going to remove what they thought was a pilonidal cyst, which is unusual for a man my age. Usually happens in people in their 20s. But they said, okay, let's take a look and see what's up. They go in there, and I credit Dr. Feinberg for doing a good job because he saved my life at that point in the fact that they hit a tumor, and I bled tremendously, and I came out with blood pressure like 80 over 40 or something along those lines, lost a lot of blood. But they found a very rare form of cancer, a chondrosarcoma, which is a soft tissue cancer starting in the cartilage. And from what we understand, they sent a biopsy they took out that time off the Mayo Clinic, and the guys up there said, hey, ain't seen this before. And subsequently found out there had been, what we understand, less than 500 documented cases of this kind of cancer. And so we, at that point, were turned over to some folks at the University of Chicago to get the tumor extracted. We radiated the area after the tumor was taken out in hopes that that would kill any remaining cancer cells, but some did remain and got my bloodstream and have moved elsewhere now and into my lungs. But there's not a lot known about it, and it's one of the, you know, they when they took the tumor out, it was sent to the Mayo Clinic too. Guys trying to make it grow so they can do a little research on it. But because there's less than 500 cases documented, it's one of those things that unfortunately there's not too many people whose lives it touched. So there's not a lot of to do about, you know, finding a cure for it because it's very, very rare.
What were your feelings as you were going through that initial process?
Well, some interesting things happened. I was in the recovery room from what I thought was the taking out of the cyst when the doctor came in and told me, he said, we found a tumor, it's cancerous, and we don't know a lot about it. And I'd always, if you'd asked me the day before, you know, what I would respond in that, or a year before, or 2 years before, I would have said I'd been angry, I would have been mad and upset. But it's interesting that the only words that came to my mind were, make a joyful noise unto the Lord. And it's interesting how your faith kicks in at times like this and is there to help support you. And anger never came about, and that has been the biggest surprise to me.
It's clear to me that humor was a big reason that you were able to survive.
Oh, that's been a part of my life all along is see, God gave me the ability to see humor in really bizarre situations sometimes, you know, in all this stuff. And laughter, yeah, keeping a sense of humor about it, because none of us are going to get out of this alive. And as I read, and I wish Price, I wish I could remember his first name, who's a paraplegic who does commentaries on National Public Radio, has a book. And one thing he says in there is that what, as he put it, he and his fellow GIMPs call the rest of us is the temporarily abled. And, I mean, we're all just a misstep or an accident away from not being able-bodied, as we call it. And so, you know, I get cancer of the butt. I mean, that's funny. I mean, I don't care how you look at it. That's funny. You know, I mean, it just is. And especially, you know, especially when they tell me, you know, I'm a large guy, I'm overweight. And they said, you know, it's good that you were because it grew out into your soft tissue instead of into vital organs, you know. So, I mean, that's just, you know, the doctor's telling me it's good that I was overweight. I mean, come on. And there's a lot of funny things that happen. You've got to look for that. I have to anyway. Look for that that humor that are in things because it just jumps out at you. And you've got to laugh at it when it happens.
Charles had a terrific sense of humor, and for many years in the early 90s was part of one of AM 580's most beloved segments, the Talk to Ed skits.
Hello, I'm Bill Cullen, and welcome to Tell the Truth. Now let's greet tonight's contestants, all claim to be downstate Illinois' only full-time radio meteorologist.
My name is Ed Kieser.
My name is Ed Kieser.
I'm meteorologist Ed Kieser.
Okay, let's go to our celebrity panel. Dorothy Kilgallen, your question, please.
Number one, what is a harvest moon?
That's when a farmer forgets to wear his suspenders.
Well, Bennett Cerf, your question?
Number two, where does it rain in Spain?
As Tattoo would say, the plane.
And Kitty Carlisle, your final question.
Number three, who is colder to you, an American or European model?
The bottom line is persistent surges of cold air continue to show up on both the European and American models.
Okay, panel, who is Ed Kieser?
Well, number two is so culturally literate, she must be working in public radio. I say number two.
Well, I like number two as well. She looks like a full-time radio meteorologist.
I was going to pick number three, but he's too boring. I'll pick number two.
Well, let's find out who the real meteorologist is and talk to Ed.
But Charles also had a serious side, and extremely important to him was ethics. In 1999, he took on author Harold Geither on the publication of his book, Animal Rights.
You write that one of the goals of the movement is to launch public education and propaganda campaigns in support of their positions. And in your acknowledgments, you point out that various research grants that enabled you to travel and gather data, one of those was from the Illinois Pork Producers Association, one of the groups you mentioned, which launches its own public education and propaganda campaigns and is often certainly in opposition to animal rights concerns, if not animal welfare concerns. Are you at all concerned that the use of pork producers' money in any way taints the or lessens the validity of the book?
I don't really think so. In the Pork Producers Project, we were trying to look at relative costs of producing pork out in the field.
We're starting an ethics library here at the station, in memoriam of when I pass and so forth. And I've had people tell me that what they liked most about me or what they remembered and respected most about me was my independence of thought and things of that nature that were at the time things that they hated most about me. And I thought that was very interesting, that in the long haul, some of the things that people didn't like about me are the things they remember most and actually, in the long haul, respect most.
Throughout the fall of 2000, Charles was in and out of the hospital. He had a half a dozen surgeries and made numerous visits to doctors in Chicago. He was determined to get back to the job he loved. And for a while, it appeared he was on the mend.
Were there any times in that series of six early surgeries that you felt that you were really and truly on the road to recovery? Or did your emotions yo-yo?
Well, after we went in for that 11-day stay, that was in October. I was sitting up by Thanksgiving just for a little while, like half hours at a time. The first half hour was on day before Thanksgiving. And then by Christmas, I was actually back to work part-time. And January through March, I was back to work full-time. Corn, soybeans, and wheat close higher for the week. We'll discuss that more today on Commodity Week. But what was happening under the skin was not recovery. Well, it was recovery, but it wasn't long-term recovery. There were still gaps in between muscles, and there were tunnels, basically, in there. And eventually, they broke through the surface. And that's when I had to go back on my stomach full-time for 8 months, basically. There were times when you got to the point where you said, this is never going to end. You know, I'm going to be here forever. Depression is a part of it, and the doctors are aware of that. And when you hit that, you talk to them about it. I didn't keep it in. You know, I called them and said, "Hey, look, you know, I'm feeling." They said, "You know, you've been through a lot. Depression is a natural thing to happen when all this finally comes crashing down on you. You know, there's only so much that the human being can bear until it does crash down on you, and you kind of fall apart." But knowing that that's normal is a great help. And having my wife there like I did, you know, we both crashed at the same time, basically. And so for a good 2 or 3 weeks, it was extremely difficult to get through the day. Around November of last year, of 2001, we go to the doctor for our normal 3-month checkup. They tell us, okay, it looks like it's to the point now where we can do a skin graft over it, and we're done with it. And so I'm looking at, this is great. By March of 2002, I should be back at work full-time, and everything should be hunky-dory. They took my regular 3-month chest x-ray, and at that point, they said everything looks fine. I come home on that Monday afternoon feeling like the world is my oyster, as they say, and I'm ready to go out and conquer everything. Then on Wednesday, we get a call, and they say that the radiologist has found something on the x-rays that the doctors didn't see at first, and I'm going to need a CAT scan and to see what's going on. And so we set up that CAT scan for a couple of weeks later because CAT scans are very busy things, and I knew right away, we spent some time crying and holding each other at that point. Everybody was telling me, don't worry, it'll be nothing, don't worry, it'll be nothing, but I knew better. You just know sometimes your body just tells you. We had the CAT scan, and it came back that there were a number of tumors, two in my left lung, and looked like one or so in my right. And they were progressing. And so the chondrosarcoma had gotten in my bloodstream and had taken up residence in my lungs. We went to specialists in Chicago again, oncologists up there trying to get into some protocol programs to test new drugs. They have some very interesting stuff out there that retards cell growth and so forth that we wanted to give a try at, hoping that we could maybe find a cure for this particular kind of cancer or at least help them with some of the general research. Unfortunately, because I still had an open wound, none of that was available. The potential for infection with an open wound is much greater, and the potential for toxicity, as they call it, death, you know, with that is much greater as well. So I couldn't get any of those programs. So we come back down here, and we basically have the option of going through radical chemotherapy, blood transfusions, and the like, or doing nothing. And went back up to Chicago to meet with the original surgeons who took it out, and their assessment was the same, that we were talking months to live, and we were talking radical therapy. In other words, your life is now the doctor's. And daily checking in, again, blood transfusions, all this stuff that's probably going to lay you flat out. And I had nurses come by from home care nurses have been coming by regularly to change this vacuum. And we discussed it with them too and brought in the family and friend and sat down, talked with them. And we came to the conclusion that we would want to live as best we can in the time that I have left, because there was no chance of a cure. There was less than 15% chance that we would respond to the therapy at all, and that response would only extend life a short period of time. But what kind of life would it be? And the toughest thing I've ever done in my life was telling my son and asking him what I should do. And he was in agreement that we would rather live to the fullest in the time we have left. And it was very difficult, but after about holding each other and crying for about 20 minutes, I was able to get a grin out of him. I said, "You know what's going to happen, Carl?" He said, "What?" I said, "I'm going to die just in time to come back as one of your kids."
There was a possibility that you might have chosen to undergo chemotherapy and potentially some radiation, and maybe right. try it just to see how your body might hold up
sure.
to it, because some people can get through it fairly simply,
yeah.
while others
Absolutely.
It's really a drag. Why did you choose not to take that option?
I'm a firm believer in God sending you messages. I believe God talks to us. I don't believe it's always, you know, the burning bush coming out and telling you what to do, but you've got to listen to the things going on around you. And my sister went and talked with, while we were, in this week we were going through this process of trying to decide. She was talking to someone, and at my wife's work, she and my wife went in there to explain the situation and her work has been very good about giving her time off to be with me at these times and so forth. And the guy said, "Yeah, I said, I understand what decision you're going through. His grandmother or someone had the same decision to make, and they made the decision to go through the chemotherapy and were dead 3 weeks later when they'd been given 6 months to live." And she came home then convinced that this was the right decision. Everything, the main thing was, we prayed about the decision, and every time I thought about going through the chemotherapy and going through the blood transfusions and all the treatments and everything, I still had questions. You know, when I thought about not doing it and accepting my fate, whatever it be, because, you know, we could still, there people have been told they have 6 months to live, 10 years later, they're still living, you know. It could go into remission, we don't know. But every time I thought of that and talked about that, a peace came over me. And that was the answer, is that there was peace in this decision. And there wasn't peace in the other decision. And so that's what it boiled down to, is it was no choice. And my sister put it very well, says choices mean there are different outcomes. And if we went through the radiation and everything, all indications were, we'd have the same outcome. I'm dead. If we don't go through it, I'm dead. Where's the choice? The choice is in how I live these last few months. That's where the choice was. And so that's the choice we took. And so I'm going to live now as best I can, while I can.
For Charles, that meant time at WILL. He produced a number of Commodity Week shows this spring. It also meant time spent with family and friends.
My dad passed away a few years ago. My sister, a few years before that, went through a stroke and brain aneurysm that had her knocked down for a while. And my mom's 77 now this year. It did. There were other family situations which I don't want to get into, because they're not my personal situations. They're personal situations of my sister that caused us not to have as much contact as we would have liked for a period of time. We have rekindled that contact before this happened, but the fact that I was suffering with this illness and needed to be taken to Chicago and back, and my wife doesn't drive, the fact that it became terminal has afforded them the opportunity to say, if we're going to know each other well in these last times, we got to do it now. It's not something we can put off. And whereas we would see each other maybe three times a year, now we're seeing each other every couple of weeks, and that's been great. And that's been a wonderful thing. And it wasn't that we were disconnected before. We were just like everybody else in the world. We had lives that we were pursuing. Now we realize that there is an end point to this that we can see coming up, and we need to take care of being together before that end point takes place.
Charles died at home on the morning of June 24th. His death leaves a void in the lives of those who knew him. This past week, Dave Dickey sat down with three of the WILL analysts who knew Charlie best: Mike Zuzulo, Paul Cooley, and Wayne Nelson.
What stories can you share that define who Charles was?
I think, Dave, the best one was the first time I came over after he had found out in the very beginning that he did have a form of cancer. And we were sitting out in the lobby before Commodity Week, and he said, you know, I'll accept the diagnosis, but I'm not going to accept the prognosis. And I think that just told me how determined a man he was. He was determined to discover the heart of agriculture by asking the hard but poignant questions. He was determined to build from nothing a type of programming very few other sources of media provide. He was determined to demand from me and all the rest of the folks the very most and the very best we had to offer each time we came together. He was also very determined to show loyalty in a world, you know, where there's not a lot of loyalty left, in my view.
Charlie was quite a person. He was a very dedicated, very driven journalist, newsman, and ag reporter. And he wanted just the best, and he did not want to compromise anything along the way. I can tell you one story that one time before Commodity Week, one analyst asked him for the questions ahead of time, and Charlie was just appalled and threatened to take him off the show altogether. So jokingly, a few of us always just continued then every time when Charlie would call his schedules and say, "Can we have the questions, Charlie?" The scowls and the looks we got were something that you didn't want to repeat or see again, because Charlie, of course, did not want to do anything like that.
Well, Charlie was extremely innovative and caring person, and sometimes felt that, and I think he liked the underdog a great deal. We all cared about that, and particularly in the sense of the farmer, who we really talked about a great deal. You know, I mentioned to Charlie once that, you know, Hubert Humphrey was a non-farmer, but he was probably the best spokesman for the farmer. And like Charlie and Hubert Humphrey, you know, he was a non-farmer, and I think he did carry on the farm conversation and the farm attitudes as good as anyone in the United States.
What will Charles' legacy in the agricultural community be?
Well, I think as we look at Charlie's legacy here, there's a lot of things that go on. And he's got a living legacy going on right now in the people that he mentored or taught a lot along the way in the business. We've got Carrie Moore right here. She's doing a wonderful job, you know, under Charlie's early guidance, you know, and she's carrying on doing tremendously. We look over at the other side of the university here. We see Todd Gleason. I mean, does it get any better than Todd and how he progressed and how he was able to go on with Charlie's help and tutoring the way? You know, what a guy, what a job he's doing over there. Tracy Bowe, who went on to be on TV in Chicago, that went to another small area town in the town of Ottawa, Illinois, and just turned the ag broadcasting around in that area, just really made it great. All people that just worked under Charlie.
That's kind of a dichotomy to me, because I think there's two. One's not so great and something that we all have to work on, and one's fantastic. The one that's not so great is the huge void of information that we're now responsible to fill with what he started. And it's not an easy task. I don't think any of us have by themselves the ability to be able to orchestrate what he was able to put together and continue on. So it's probably going to have to be a team effort at this point. The neat and wonderful, beautiful thing that we have now since he's gone is that we all have each other. You know, the people that we have that I have got to know here, I have so many good friends now that Charlie introduced me to, and I have them, and you know, that's the biggest legacy I have to rely upon right now that he's gone.
The growth of WILL and the farm broadcasting is noted throughout the commodity industry, and I think in the broadcast industry as well. The very respected Doane's Analytical Service has rated WILL as possibly the highest one in the state of Illinois. And I think his legacy is that he basically brought an idea, nurtured it, and cultivated it into a tremendous success story, and one in which the farmer
needs a spokesman and an idea and a soundboard. And I think that that's one of the best legacies that he did, that he gave the farmer a good listening soundpost to listen to.
How will you personally remember Charlie?
Personally, I'll remember Charlie as a friend. He was a person that celebrated life, a man who I cannot believe the way that he faced death. And once he knew that this cancer come along, he made you feel good when you went to see him. You thought you were going to cheer him up. And when you left, you were cheered up by Charlie, a man whose faith in God and just stability along the way could make you feel good.
Well, you know, I'll remember him of all the innovative things that we did and all the fun times that we had. Some of the Outlook meetings that we went to and some of the darndest storms that you could ever imagine, but the show went on and we did have a lot of fun and talking about that.
The biggest thing is probably the loyalty. I've always been a stickler for loyalty, and so that's a biggie for me. I think the other thing was, at some point in time, going back to I'll accept the diagnosis but not the prognosis, you would have thought after a couple years and the extreme pain that not only he but, you know, Cecily and Carl and all of his close family and friends went through, you would have thought that Charlie, of all people, would have become very bitter when his condition didn't improve after such a painful number of operations and treatments. But he did not. And in fact, he really did embrace the will of God much faster and far, far more deeply than I ever did until about Easter time. And one of the last times we talked to each other and I went over to visit him, I said, I finally overcame at Easter time and am accepting that you're going to have to leave us. And he simply told me that God does not give a person more suffering than he or she can endure. And, you know, with my weak faith, I needed that because he showed me firsthand that that is indeed true. And I think that was the biggie right there for me in terms of what I'll personally remember.
Throughout the illness, you have been very open in telling your story and have told it on a number of occasions. Has it been therapeutic?
Oh, I think very. I part of the process for me is talking about it. It's what I do for a living. I talk and I write, you know, in terms of radio and so forth. And even my avocation, my sideline is creative in that aspect and talking in front of people and so forth. Storytelling is part of who I am. You know, we're all to some degree dying, but there's a lot of people dealing with cancer. There's a lot of people dealing with life-threatening illnesses out there. And they get hushed up, and they get put aside, and they don't get talked about. And so part of my goal is to get this out in the open, not to put it in your face in a negative way, but to say, look, people, there are a lot of your friends going through this. You can be helpful to them just by emailing them, just by saying hi, just by going by and saying, good to see you again.
AM580 will establish a library on journalistic ethics at Campbell Hall in Charlie's name. If you wish to donate, please contact Joan Harshbarger at 217-333-0850. All of us at WILL offer our sympathy and support to Charles' family, who have endured a long and difficult struggle. This program was produced by Dave Dickey. I'm Jay Pierce.